Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Accusations of corruption in the Garfield County Commissioner race surfaced this week, angering one of the candidates.
These allegations are new. Ballots go out next week, so we do have to dive into this and try to discern the truth as best we can. The Democrats have put us in an interesting journalistic spot.
And the race for district attorney is heating up. Aspen Public Radio will host a live town hall debate with the three candidates on Monday, October 18th, from 6 to 7 p.m. Tune in on your radio dial, listen online, or come in person to the Dunaway Community Room in the Pitkin County Library. You can also go to aspenpublicradio.org for a complete lineup of all of our debates in the next 2 weeks. And the race between the Pitkin County Commissioners is getting more attention. A televised debate this week between Greg Poschman and Scott Ryder highlighted their temperaments.
I think we were able to highlight the differences between these two guys, and they have definitely staked out some pretty different ground politically. I do think it speaks to some real kind of tension in the community over who we are and what's our identity.
We discuss how civil discourse is shaped by the opinions of others who write letters to the editor in local papers.
If somebody says something outrageous in this community, somebody else is going to write a letter back and say, wow, you're just completely crazy.
And finally, as the election draws near, the Valley's newspapers are getting ready to make endorsements. Joining me this week are Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post-Independent, Roger Moult, columnist for the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. Thank you very much for joining me in the studio, and Randy on the phone.
Always good to be here.
Yes,
glad
thanks
to join.
Thanks for having us.
Randy, you got a great story in the Thursday's paper about the fallout from the forum with the Garfield County Commissioner candidates.
The Glenwood Chamber of Commerce's Issues and Answers Forum, you know, they in an evening run as many candidates through and representatives for ballot issues as they can. And usually it goes pretty fast. The people are very polite to each other, and it's fairly dull. Let's just be honest about it. Last night was different. There's a contentious district attorney race that also involves folks in Aspen, and Randy Baumgardner actually made an appearance against his opponent in his state Senate race. And then came the county commission race, John Martin, Commissioner for Life, who is seeking his sixth term as a county commissioner, and John Acho, the Democrat. And Martin started it off with a real bombshell, saying, yesterday I was in the county attorney's office and the Democrats presented me with an ultimatum that I needed to resign, ensure that there wouldn't be an effort to replace me on the ballot, and move to Delta County and live out my life, where they would try to get me indicted for allegations of corruption. And I do want to point out that John Acha, the Democratic candidate, said, really? I didn't know about this. We had written a story a couple weeks ago, maybe it was just last week, based on our editorial board interview with Acha, in which the county Democratic assistant chairman or deputy chairman told us about the 19 open records requests they had filed with the county, and then said that we'll be unveiling our findings on our website through October 15th. And so we filed an open records request for the letters that the Democrats had filed to see what they were looking for, and wrote a story about the fact that this was coming. So the substance of this is allegations that John Martin got a per diem from the county and maybe separate meal reimbursement from the county. I don't have the document in front of me. We're working on it further today. And also was reimbursed from an association, and it might be the National Association of Counties, and Martin's involved in a couple. We have to figure that out too. We have to go deeper. John Martin says he didn't do anything wrong. We need to get him to elaborate on that and explain if that money was reimbursed, if it was somehow otherwise permissible. And I think it added up to about $5,000, which if true, it would be wrong. I mean, if true, there's no, you know.
That seems like a pretty big threat. Like, move out of this county.
Look, if the Democrats really have, I mean, they obviously can't indict anybody themselves. They would have to turn this over to the district attorney, who would probably want to turn it over to somebody from another county to look at it. There would be a long process involved before you would figure out if there were any criminal charges to bring and so forth.
What kind of a threat is it, really? If there's something to it, the DA ought to know about it anyway, and if they're going to go after him, I mean, why would he resign? I mean, it just doesn't, it seems like, what's the substance there? My point, I guess, is if he resigns, none of it goes away, so why would he resign?
He either did something that's indictable or not.
Right.
I mean, at the forum, he, in effect, called their bluff and publicized it on his own terms instead of trying to let them control the narrative.
You know, Randy, have you been noticing, I thought it was, it's been interesting coming from his opponent, these daily press releases that he's been issuing in response to decisions being made by the board.
And those are, most of those things have been written about. Most of those things have been examined. The county has purchased buildings, and the Democrats say they're sweetheart deals.
With no proof.
That's fair. You can, as part of a campaign, you can say, look at this. We don't think this was good stewardship of money. I mean, that's a fair campaign point.
Sure, but we're not going to, as journalists, we're not biting on it. I'm certainly not.
Well, I mean, given the fact that we wrote about these things 2 and 3 years ago, for the most part.
Right.
We don't really, you know, we do have limited resources, so we don't really feel a need to re-report that stuff. Now, these allegations are new. Ballots go out next week, so we do have to dive into this and try to discern the truth as best we can. And it puts us in a difficult spot, really, because we talk about, you know, the district attorney would probably have to go to another county to get somebody to look at it. And that's going to take weeks, if not months, to really suss out what happened.
Well, after the election.
Yeah.
And with subpoena power, which we don't have. So the Democrats have put us in an interesting journalistic spot. It's generously, I'll say it's an interesting campaign tactic.
What seems disturbing most to me about this is the Democrats have seemed to taken a page out of the Donald Trump playbook here, which,
yeah,
you know, why do that?
Randy, you're going to moderate a debate between these guys on Wednesday, October 19th, which we're airing that day. Are you going to follow up on that?
Darn right.
Conversation? Good.
Yeah, I was thinking about the kinds of questions to ask. Of course, that's going to be influenced by what comes out in the next few days.
So that's Wednesday, October 19th, 6 to 7, right here on Aspen Public Radio. For the rest of the forums that we're hosting and having debates on, you can go to aspenpublicradio.org. Curtis, you had a debate that you held on Wednesday night in conjunction with the Aspen Times, and that it's labeled Squirm Night, and it actually kind of lived up to its name this time around. The commissioner candidates Greg Poschman and Scott Ryder.
It's not like we had a bunch of gotcha questions lined up for these guys.
Although that round was pretty good.
The lightning round was fine. No one can name the undersheriff for the assistant county manager.
Don't know the budget. They don't know anybody on the planning commission.
But I think we were able to highlight the differences between these two guys, and they have definitely staked out some pretty different ground politically. You know, it's been a while since anyone has put any any potential criminal indictments on the table in Pitkin County. So sometimes it's easy to feel like our issues are kind of cute and quaint up here, but I do think it speaks to some real kind of tension in the community over who we are and what's our identity. I think some of the most heated moments of the debate turned on one candidate, Scott Ryder, has had a career in real estate development, and his opponent, Greg Poschman, has basically said, I think that's disqualifying for being a member of the Pitkin County Commission, which for 40 years has had, you know, its main mission has been holding down growth, down zoning areas that could be developed heavily so that doesn't happen. And so Greg has based his whole campaign on we need balance and sort of a traditional Pitkin County commissioner sort of outlook. Scott Ryder has said he wants more opportunity. He's spoken a lot about the challenges of young people to find housing and have careers here, and there needs to be more opportunity for these folks. And so we definitely saw a lot of clashes on this. One thing I found interesting was Scott was almost able to kind of stay on message more. He could keep going back to, well, I just want more opportunity, even though he was a little light on specifics on exactly how that would happen. And Greg just kind of, you know, almost would kind of needle him a little bit.
Yeah, it was something like, well, who's that? Who are you going to sacrifice? Your maid? The guy who cuts your grass? Yeah. Or somebody else? Like, it was kind of a jab there. Did Scott respond to that?
Yeah, he did. What did he say?
He said he cuts my own grass and I don't have a maid. What do we think about raising the occupation of Greg's wife?
Absolutely. I thought that was a really good point. I mean, she does represent developers. And is the spouse the same as the candidate? I mean, it's the same thing with Hillary and Bill.
Certainly according to Donald Trump.
But, right. Yeah. So, and
I don't know how I feel about that.
Is it something that needs to be pointed out in the press?
Scott's trying to point it out to label Greg as like a hypocrite.
We have a debate between these two on Tuesday.
Yeah.
October 18th, and I'm wondering if I should be bringing this up.
Well, I think it's fair to bring it up, but I don't think it's fair to assume that Greg necessarily has the same political ideas as his wife does.
Right.
So, sure. Yeah, I think it's fair game to bring that up and ask him about that, or if that's going to influence him or not.
Mm-hmm. Or how they will handle that if there is a potential conflict where there's a development in Pitkin County that the board has oversight on.
Yeah. There was one thing interesting in the debate, but it was something Scott said about how we've built all this employee housing and we have now workers who don't have jobs. So, yeah, that's a point I've made before, that once we create employee housing and put people in them, we're obligated to create jobs for them, which I would, you know, connect the dots and say that leads to more growth in the county. So I think that was a bigger point than what it was talked about in the media or even in the debate itself.
Well, I would point out that Pitkin County has maybe the lowest unemployment rate in the state. You could certainly argue that there's not a lot of quality jobs.
You could build 1,000 units and just be catching up.
There's not a lot of professional level jobs that is going to enable someone to raise a family. There's a lot of jobs. But Greg has said that, and I know, and you've mentioned this too a lot in your columns, that so much of our population base in the Upper Valley is in these employee housing units. So what does that mean when we talk about the housing program as it relates to the overall growth and carrying capacity of this valley? And Greg has spoken to that perhaps in some more nuanced terms, while Scott has talked about how we need more opportunity for people in the housing realm.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, an analysis and commentary of the week's news with writers and editors. That was Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. I'm now joined by Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent, and Roger Moreau, columnist for the Aspen Times. Randy, besides the accusations that are flying around in that forum, what's the issue? What are they debating in Garfield County? And also, what about the DA's race on your side of the valley?
Well, there's nothing new in county politics. I mean, it's all about oil and gas and you know, the county reserve and how the county gets along with municipalities. But the DA's race is pretty darn interesting. As you've had in the Aspen papers and on Aspen Public Radio, the incumbent county attorney, Sherry Kaloya, had conflicts with some law enforcement officers. In the case of the Pitkin County Sheriff, she would like him to release less information. In the case of the Garfield County Sheriff, he complains that she makes it too hard for officers to get warrants, to get arrest warrants. She readily says, "I am a check on law enforcement. I make them work hard enough to feel confident that they're going to bring me a case that I can win." And then, of course, she's criticized for plea bargains, which any DA is going to be criticized for plea bargains. Any of these candidates who say that they will plea bargain less are fibbing, because the system would break if,
absolutely,
you know, if the vast, vast, vast majority of cases weren't plea bargained. Jeff Cheney's the Republican candidate against Sherry. Sherry's the Democratic incumbent. Sherry defeated Cheney's boss last time, Martin Beeson, narrowly. I think that Cheney's opponents fear that he will return to seeking the highest possible charge. There was a feeling, I think, that Beeson overcharged some people. I wasn't here, so this
yeah,
is
he did.
Background that I hear. And then there's an independent in the race, Chip McCrory, who used to be a prosecutor and has been a defense attorney in town, and who makes the contention that he is the most experienced criminal lawyer in the race, and before he became a defense attorney, had more prosecutorial experience than either of the other two. We spent a little over an hour with each of them, and I wish every race had candidates who were as well backgrounded, as clear, I think, in their own minds of what they want to do. It's kind of a, you know, who can be tough on crime or who can keep people from having their life ruined. I mean, the prosecutor does have those things in their hand, and I think that in the end, whoever is elected, the difference will be less than it sounds like in the campaign, because the caseload is what it is. Sherry contends that, you know, despite Lou Valario, who supports Cheney, being highly critical of her, that in the interest of putting criminals in jail, she and the sheriff's department work together on most cases without any problem, and I do believe that that's true.
Yeah, so
I think they're good candidates, and,
yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a good discussion, and I hope people take their vote really seriously rather than making it a party line vote.
What I wanted to say was, you know, you should care about this race a lot. If you are convicted of a crime ever, if you have a friend who's been convicted of a crime, or you're a victim of a crime, it matters who is the chief law enforcement official in your district. You know, I think people don't pay attention to this kind of stuff as much as they should, because it really matters about how your law enforcement acts because of your DA, mm-hmm. and everybody who works underneath that person.
Right.
So I'm preparing right now, because we're doing a live debate with the candidates on Monday, October 17th at 6 o'clock. So you can either come to the library, Pitkin County Library, or you can listen to it.
It'll be interesting to see how we have a legitimate third-party candidate in this race. Where is this really going to shake out? Is the winner of this race going to get over 40% of the vote?
Yeah, we'll see. It's a question that I want them to talk about on Monday. Does party really matter in this race?
It shouldn't. I mean, it's not a party politics kind of thing in my mind, and especially in this area, I think it should play less of a.
It's the same thing with the Pitkin County commissioners. One's, you know, touting himself as an independent. One's saying
right.
he's a Democrat. Same thing in Garfield County, where I think it probably matters more.
Well, it's. I think the races around here are more ideological. I mean, we're not appointing Supreme Court justices and.
We sure act like it.
Yeah, we do, don't we?
Yeah. Switching topics, Curtis and I were invited to a media panel at Aspen City Hall to talk to city employees about how to deal with the press and what they can do better and what we can do better for them. It was sparsely attended, which was disappointing. And the issue came up about many people in the city feel like they're being beaten up on by the press. What it really came down to, the conversation shifted to, well, it's not just really the news articles that the journalists are writing, it's the opinion pages and the letters to the editor. And the city of Aspen particularly, I think that's the one government in the valley that gets beat up on the most. Mm-hmm. It gets the most scrutiny. It's the county seat up here, and they operate on a $160 million budget, and they operate a lot of different things. The conversation went to, well, their letters to the editor, and I know when I was the editor of the Daily News, and I got the criticism all the time, like, why do you let these guys continue to write these letters? They're just rants, and it's misinformation. It's not factual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a good conversation that, Curtis, I think you started about, well, people have a right to share their opinions.
Right. Well, and I think there's not a whole lot of understanding out there. I think a lot of these folks were surprised to hear that we do print most of the letters we get.
It's like 90%, right? And that's what you say too, Randy.
It's hard to put an exact number on it because it just depends. It's certainly not the New York Times where they get to, you know, toss out 99% of the letters and only pick the ones that they think are really good and really inform the debate. You know, frankly, I wish we were in that position, but the reality is we're a small community newspaper, and so I think our default is to give people the room to have an opinion and just throw out the stuff that's obviously garbage. So if there's clearly libel or slander in there or something that is obviously blatantly false, we are going to weed that out, or hopefully we are going to not print that. You get into some gray areas when you have letters that are making certain assertions. You know,
particularly now during this election season,
mm-hmm. Right? And so we will certainly try and either follow back up with a writer to make sure, you know, fact check certain things. But there can be a little bit of a fine line there. Right? How much time do you spend with one letter writer going back and forth on something?
Well, you want to have a right hand person to do just that. Yeah. So you can prevent people like Roger Marolt from coming up with pseudonames and having fake.
You're going to go there again.
I'm going there right away because not everybody has as long of a history as we do.
Yes.
So you might want to share with the listeners how you got past us editors as a private citizen. This is Valley Roundup, a weekly media roundtable of analysis and commentary with writers and editors. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. We now continue our discussion about how the letters to the editor are vetted for the local newspaper's opinion pages.
What Carolyn is talking about is fake letters, and I did it by inventing 27 different names and over a period of 4 years writing several hundred letters to the editors.
And what years were these?
It was the turn of the century, early 2000 through 2004. But Curtis hit on something, and the reason I had to invent 27 different names is because after a while, if you use the same name, then I think the editors thought that, well, we've heard from this person enough, we need to give somebody else a voice, which is legitimate, I think.
By the way, ever since this incident went down, and this was before my time too, there is a strict mandate that when you get a letter to the editor, you have to call the person to confirm they actually exist.
Right.
And so you have these really funny phone calls where you call the person and you say, hi, is Roger Marolt there? And he's like, yeah, this is Roger. Did you send us a letter to the editor? Yeah.
Great.
Okay,
thanks. Even though it might be Jeff who answered.
Well, I was pretty bold in those days. Every once in a while, I would just walk one in and hand it to whoever was at the front desk and that seemed to work the best. Then I wouldn't get any phone calls, but nobody would check it. But at any rate, I think there's this spectrum in the community. You have reporters who are primarily concerned about the facts and getting the story out there. And then you have the letter writers who are the readers. So it's important to know how they're perceiving the facts. Mm-hmm. And I think it's self-policing in one regard, that if somebody says something outrageous in this community, somebody else is going to write a letter back and say, wow, you're just completely crazy. And then you have columnists who are somewhere in between where we react and we try to throw a few facts in there to support our reaction to that. So I think the combination of all of that works pretty well. I think the one weakness in it is, again, what Curtis pointed out, is where you have a handful of letter writers who write all the time, and the readers of the local papers just get inundated with the same message from the same people. And not that the readers can't discern and make sense out of that. I think it just gets a little boring.
Yeah. I did say at that panel that, you know, some, I used to put people on ice when I thought they had had enough, you know, space.
I think that's fair. I don't think that's
Randy,
censoring.
Do you have a policy down there at the Glenwood Post-Independent?
Well, I try to run as many letters as I can, and I would guess that I'm over 90%. I do, the letters that I reject most routinely are those from outside the market. I save our space for people here. And then I have some regular letter writers who have trouble with facts, and I'll go back and forth with them a little bit on just trying to be sure that they stay kind of within the realm of opinion and don't throw things out that are demonstrably not true, like Obama was born in Kenya, or I have one guy who loves to point out that National Security Advisor, whose name is escaping me, was born in Iran. She was, but John McCain was born in Panama. You know, they're children of people in foreign service or in the military. So I'll send letters back to people with links to fact-checking sites and say, you know, rework this, or I'll just take things out, and then if they don't want to write letters anymore, we're probably both okay with that, right?
What about that tool that I've seen editors use? Not very often, but someone will write a letter, and then the editors will footnote it and say, this is not true, or this is a mistake.
I do that when somebody makes an assertion about something we've written, and that their assertion mischaracterizes what we do. So I don't want to get into a situation where somebody can say, oh, you're censoring my opinion about you, but I also don't want people to wantonly distort what we've said.
One note on that. I mean, as editors, we are censors. Come on. I mean,
that's true.
We censor all kinds of things. It's our judgment. We do it in the best way we can in the public interest, but we're censoring.
But I
was talking specifically about when somebody has an opinion about something that we've written.
Right.
Same. But this story was totally false, and you never contacted such and such source. And then editors note the reporter did contact that source, and they didn't respond.
Things so, like that.
Yeah. On to the election.
Yeah.
A couple more weeks to go. Be taking a vacation starting November 9th.
Oh, here's one more question. When will we expect endorsements coming out of the Glenwood Post-Independent and the Aspen Daily News?
We'll start to roll ours out next week.
Sounds about right.
And I love
ballots go out next week, so I'm, you know, going to try to get them in.
I wish somebody would do a story on the percentage of candidates winning if they got an endorsement. I think it's been the opposite a lot. It's like the kiss of death sometimes.
Oh, that'd be interesting to track that. Maybe someone will do that.
I would love for somebody to do that. Okay, well, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you, Carol.
Sure thing. Bye.
That was Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post-Independent, and Roger Morrill, columnist for the Aspen Times. I'm Carolyn Sakariasin, and you've been listening to Valley Roundup. You can also get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.